Now to the executive committee, we have four action items for today. The first is approval of student residency appeal policy. Action item number one, it covers pages 1 through 14. I will entertain a motion from the committee members, Regents Johnson, Bell, and Ridley, for consideration of this item.
I'll move. So move.
So moved by Regent Ridley, seconded by Regent Bell. You have a presenter, anyone on this, Mr. Preston?
I don't think so, unless David or Brian.
Go ahead. It's really academic affairs policy.
Well, that's true. Okay. Well, we could kind of flip for this, but a few years ago, about a year or so ago, we had a student who appealed a determination of her residency status. She said that she should be treated as an in-state student, but through our process, we had determined that she was really an out-of-state student, and she appealed that. We discovered, I guess, a couple of things. One was that we had no mechanism particularly for hearing that appeal, and that there was a state administrative regulation that required us to have such a thing. So what you have before you is essentially what that state regulation stipulates needs to be part of an appeals process for residency determinations. And as part of that, it stipulates that it has to be approved by the institution's governing board. It strikes me as a pretty elaborate and complicated process, but it's exactly what the administrative regulation says we have to do. So we've essentially photocopied the administrative regulation and presented it as our policy and ask you all to consider and approve that.
Is it fair to say this is a liability control issue? Is that?
Not really. I'm not sure. It's not the only student appeal procedure that's mandated by statute. And I think there's a sensitivity to students who are their residents.
And part of the reason why we didn't know we didn't have this policy was that we don't get these appeals very often. And so it was a bit of a surprise. But we are supposed to have this. It's supposed to be filed with CPE. And we're, in a sense, kind of cleaning house and asking you all to approve this.
The President's the last decision maker if it goes that far?
Yes.
Any other questions? Call the vote. All in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Passes unanimously. Next item is action item two with regard to the staff emeritus appointment. Regent Smith, are you presenting on that?
I am.
Great.
Need a motion?
Yeah, you should.
So moved.
Second.
Got a motion by Regent Ridley, seconded by Regent Johnson.
Well, I would be remiss if I didn't start with pointing out that this is the first time that the staff emeritus appointment has appeared on a Board of Regents agenda. This is a new human resource policy only implemented in November of last year, and I was going to thank Tony Glisson and Ann Mead for their support, but I think they both left. But when the staff council and I first approached them with this idea, they were completely behind it. So the staff council and I were looking for ways to recognize and honor the valuable staff who contribute so much to the success of the university. So together we drafted a policy to create this new designation as a way to recognize a retired staff member who served for a minimum length of time, retired in good standing. But most importantly, the policy states this should be awarded only to those who have demonstrated the highest levels of commitment and passion to WKU, the other thing that's so hard to quantify. Which is why I'm honored to recommend on behalf of the staff council and myself, Mrs. Pat Johnson, who is with us today in the back. Raise your hand, Pat. Just a little bit, and it's very hard to try and summarize a 27-year career in just a few sentences, but Freddie said I couldn't go for 45 minutes. So, Pat did work for information technology for 27 years before retiring earlier this year. I'm sure I can't do justice to her career, but when I look at the 3-page nomination that was submitted to the staff council who reviewed it, several items really stood out. She had a job that had her work with people all across campus, but she didn't just do that job and work with people. She really built relationships with them. The term mentor came up frequently, that she mentored those around her and those who worked with her in her areas. It was stated that she embodied WKU spirit makes a master, and another person stayed truly exemplified the Western spirit daily. It was her dedication to the university, quoting another person, made her a sought-after member of various university committees. She also had previously served on the staff council and the university benefits committee, both of which are very time-consuming and things that not required for someone to do, but she went above and beyond. Let's see. And in closing, she was and continues to be, because I see her at the ball games, very dedicated to WKU. So thank you for your consideration. Thank you, Dr. Ransel, for allowing us to implement this new policy.
Thank you, Tamara. Anyone have any other comments?
I'm really pleased to see you, Pat, that you're the inaugural one.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It seems like she's been here forever, but maybe I was. But I think that one of the remarkable things about Pat and is that she's been part of the team that has helped build our extraordinary infrastructure for everything to do with IT. And I know you're sitting over there, Gordon. She probably kept you straight,
I'm living
too.
In her
but,
show.
But you know, I think it's easy somehow, you know, where we are now and where we were. And so it's not just somebody who's done exceptional in their work, but it's somebody who's actually been there and helped build us to where we are in a way that we can sustain it. And it seemed like Pat was always part of something being done that was important to get it to where it is. So thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else? We'll call for the vote. All in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Passes unanimously. Congratulations. Thank you for your service.
Thank you.
Congratulations. Next item, number three, is the addendum to the athletic employment contract. Hudson, I hear a motion.
I'll make a motion.
Moved by Regent Bale.
I'll second.
Seconded by Regent Johnson. Todd, are you presenting on this, or do you?
The only thing I would say on both that one and the next one is they are four-year extensions under the exact same terms they currently are under. There is no change in the financial aid.
Anyone have any questions or comments?
I think it speaks volumes for the success of these individuals and their desire to stay at a university, because we all know once you reach a pinnacle of a career, there are phone calls that are made to try to lure you away. And for once again, as we talk about a 27-year career with Pat and you saying the other thing, that sometimes speaks great things about the university, and I agree. That's a great thing.
Thank you. Anyone else? Call for the vote. All in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Passes unanimously. Moving to the last action item, athletic employment contract addendum for Jason Nidell.
I approve. I move to approve.
Moved by Regent Johnson.
Second.
And by Regent Ridley. Any other comment, Todd, from the original? You said it.
Yeah, I thought those were the same.
Any questions or comments from others? Call the vote. All in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Passes unanimously. That concludes our action items. We now move to the information items. The first is the endowed professorships. Mark?
Thank you. Well, I didn't bring any brains, but I'm going to talk about brains. So we have that in common, at least. The last meeting of the group, there was a little bit of discussion about professorships at the university, and we thought it might be useful to take just a few minutes and share a little bit of information about those that we have, how many we have, when we acquired them, and how they're distributed across the university. I'll say a little bit about how they're used, although I'll defer to my colleague David Lee if you have some more technical questions about how they're used in certain departments. Because the term professorship may not be very familiar to everybody. I thought I'd just kind of touch on some things. The specifics do vary greatly across various colleges and departments, and Dr. Lee cites that as a strength, allowing different disciplines a variety of ways to structure their professorships that suit their discipline. They may be funded or even endowed. Some are merely named. They're usually an appointment for a specific period. There are periodic reviews, and frequently, and this is important, a significant portion of the funds that result from those endowments is used to support salary. Some of the funds are frequently reserved to enhance certain faculty activities. We'll talk about that. Visiting professors in particular may be of any rank, but are usually a one-year appointment. So that's just a 100,000-foot view of the basics of professorships. I thought we'd dial in a little bit and see in particular what some of the... Oops, let me back up here. Oops, we're going to fight this thing. Dean Katz shared with me in his particular case how he utilizes his professorships, and this is really true across all our campus. One of the foremost reasons we have them is for recruiting and retaining top talent. Again, because a significant portion of the resulting funds goes to supporting salary, this allows deans to be able to compete and elevate a program, maybe boost a specific program that they deem of critical importance. For the purposes of recruiting, there's a little bit of branding going on. It is an evidence of a vibrant, constituent-funded, donor-funded culture at that school. So a potential faculty member is going to say that looks promising. And it creates institutional prestige, often one of the more subtle measurements of what's considered a high-caliber department across the nation by faculty, staff, and even donors, is how many endowed professorships they may possess. And as described earlier, some of the funds are used to enhance research, teaching, and scholarly activities, and in turn, that increases their brand impact because they're going to be invited to national meetings, they'll bring students using funds from their professorship, etc. So all those things play into the power of a professorship. Now, there are some standard amounts that we look to as we have conversations with donors. Obviously, most things are variable, but this gives you some idea of the basics. We currently have approximately $29 million in endowed professorships here at Western. In Gordon Ford, there are 11, and to give you a sense of how creatively these can be structured, while typically they are endowed, because you're talking about long-term base support for a faculty member, a position. There have been occasions where sometimes they are paid annually over a long term. That allows a donor to get in at maybe a better entry point at cost and still have the joy and the excitement of having supported a professor. That particular one is ultimately secured by a deferred gift that, when realized, will be an endowment. I want to share with you a little bit of the metrics associated with our professorships. There are 39 at WKU. You can see that when they were acquired is really in a burst across the two campaigns. More recently, we have not acquired very many as our fundraising interests have been in other quarters. By type, you can see that they're predominantly professorships with some incomplete ones still to be grown. By school, they're predominantly found in Gordon Ford and in Ogden, but scattered across many other entities across campus. And by discipline, they're most prevalent in engineering and management, with several other departments there on the left shown as well in a complete list on the right. I want to take just a minute to put some faces to these. Dr. Katz, who wasn't able to remain for this, wanted me to just mention Whitney Peake's role as a professor. You'll see when we think about university impact in the community that more than 1,300 hours of consulting is very relevant when we talk about our impact on the local economy. In the sciences, note that first bullet. Here's a person who's been really behind some remarkable curricular innovations, who is a leader in policy, who is still innovating new courses. even outside our area. And as you'll see at the bottom bullet is one of the people who's got a lot to do with how well we continue to do in the concrete canoe competition, the bridge competition, and other engineering engaged learning opportunities. Oops. Dr. Julia Roberts, of course, almost needs no introduction. Her role in leadership at the Gatton Academy is tremendous. And of course, we appreciate all she does there. That's made possible in part by the McHurin Endowed Professorship. And of course, the Jerry Baker Professorship of Music makes an impact there. Lastly, I wanted to just take a moment to talk about the donors who've been behind this. There have been quite a few. I won't read the list, but you have it. And even some corporations that have been able to step up and support professorships. This is a growing trend. Usually you'll see when a corporation supports a professorship, it is to build intellectual capital in their particular sector of industry or field of endeavor. That's the end of my presentation. If I can answer any questions.
Been an important part of being competitive with faculty, but also a mechanism in our growing philanthropic support of the university.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Next information item is the state legislative update, federal budget, overview,
I'll be brief. You all received this week a communique from Robin Taylor summarizing the legislative process as the 2017 General Assembly comes to a close. They will come back together next week and then adjourn permanently by the end of the week. We had five bills that directly affected us. Senate Bill 153 was a performance funding bill, which I'll talk more about in a moment. Senate Bill 147 lifted the caps on advanced practice doctoral degrees, which is very important to us. There was a cap of 18 shared among the six comprehensive universities, including Kentucky State, we'd simply reached that cap, and this bill was necessary to lift that cap, and now that is now open-ended. And that's a very important variable for us going forward in the creation of terminal degrees, advanced practice doctorates that are important in our responsibility to meet the economic development priorities across our region of Kentucky. Most of ours are in the healthcare, doctor of education, physical therapy, nursing practice, and psychology are the four that we have. And there will be more in the future, and this opens the door for that as needed. The process now goes through CPE to approve these going forward. Senate Bill 107, of importance to our governing boards. Chairman Higdon and I met with Senate President Robert Stivers a few weeks ago specifically to discuss this bill. The bill has passed both chambers and signed into law by the governor. I won't go into all the details, but it does make provisions for the governor to remove individual board members if a board is deemed to be out of compliance for reasons related to party, race, or in some cases, gender, proportional board representation. The governor to remove an entire board if a board is deemed to be dysfunctional. And the bill also requires university board appointees to be confirmed by the Senate. And that last one is probably the most significant variable going forward. Requires Senate confirmation of recommendation.
That was already in the statute.
No.
Senate confirmation of board?
No. Was not.
Oh, you all did. No. This is the first.
That's new.
In fact, that was probably the most discussed element. Jennifer?
Yes. So Senate confirmation has been there for other boards. But for university, Board of Regents or Board of Trustees, it was never in statute for the Senate to confirm. So this will be new for us.
Yeah.
But other boards had that.
Yeah.
Just we were excluded.
Yeah. It's correct. Yeah.
Universities were
Didn't realize that. Thank you.
Senate Bill 17 is a free speech bill that some of our faculty are a little stressed over, but students, this is primarily aimed for K through 12, but students at all levels, including post-secondary, are free to express religious or political beliefs in school assignments without discrimination, is the basis for that particular bill. And we'll track that going forward. I don't know that that will have a dramatic impact on us, but, you know, I expect this one will get tested at some point.
I do have a quick question about that. It also does mention organizations, student organizations. I don't know if we have an answer for this, but does that negate our student non-discrimination policy? So if a student organization wanted to form and exclude black students or Muslim students, that is against our code of non-discrimination. But according to this bill, the university, or if it were at a high school, could not interfere in that. So does that affect registered student organizations?
That way.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I didn't interpret it that way, but Jay Todd, I'm not going to say yay or nay just because I don't want to misspeak on that. But I have not drawn that conclusion. I would expect our policies to still be in effect of non-discrimination and prudence. But like I said, this one will likely get tested before long on one campus or one high school or another.
I think what the statute does is simply make what we had already been doing, WKU and other universities, statutory. Because we've had non-discrimination clauses in place for decades.
And no one had told me up front that it does invalidate a university non-discrimination policy. But the way I read it is that it has implications for that. So thank you for answering.
What it probably does do is protect a student who expresses their beliefs from being disciplined.
As it should.
House Bill 471, fully fund veterinary medicine on common contracts basis held for Kentucky students at out-of-state institutions. It also includes a lease agreement between the University of Kentucky College of Medicine and the Medical Center of Bowling Green, which paves the way for your case to lease space from the Medical Center here in Bowling Green for a medical school that you all are already paying. Those are the five bills that primarily affected us that came out of the General Assembly.
Jerry, just one comment on the Senate Bill 17. As J.T. was asking his question, I'm just wondering how that will play out. There's no question about can express without discrimination. How it's expressed is an entirely different question, and do our current policies address that?
How one expresses?
In other words, the opportunity to express is addressed, but the medium, manner in which you express.
Right, we have time and place for people who want to orate on campus, and as far as when and where you can express your beliefs or opinions, you're pretty much unlimited, except that the student cannot interfere with the educational mission and processes. So if they're speaking out in class about their political beliefs and it's interfering with the course curriculum, then that's something we can address.
I asked that. I know there was a time where California campuses created a free speech or a free speech wall or a free speech something as a way of having some control on potential damaging of property or marking up space or whatever, and I just wonder if you've addressed that.
Did that answer your question?
The
crux of this bill, Jennifer, correct me if I'm wrong, the crux of this bill was primarily aimed at allowing students to express religious or political beliefs and not be downgraded in a paper or in a class discussion. In other words, if I remember disagreeing with the position a student is taking and giving them a D on that paper because they disagree, it allows a student to express their beliefs without fear of discrimination in the grading process.
That is part of it, yes.
Yeah. And I think that got the most discussion as this bill went through the General Assembly. And, you know, that's the one that I fear has the most potential for litigation, because a student expresses a belief, it's a bad grade, and blames it on that.
Mm-hmm.
and that's going to be a delicate matter for a member of the faculty or the student to litigate.
This is the last thing I wanted to say about this. I pulled this up because I wanted to read it verbatim what it does say. It says, and you're absolutely right, it does talk about the course assignments, but in the last page it says, no recognized religious or political student organization is hindered or discriminated against in the ordering of its internal affairs, selection of leaders and members, defining of doctrines and principles, and resolving of organizational disputes in the furtherance of its mission or in its determination that only persons committed to its mission should conduct such activities. The way I read that is that student organizations would not have to follow non-discrimination policies because that would be protective.
I would not read it that way.
Okay. I'm glad to hear that.
What it might be, and I'm just, I wasn't there when this was debated in Frankfurt, but if a Jewish student organization wanted to limit their members to people of the Jewish religion, sure, I think they could do that. But if they want to say, you know, the Jewish students, they must be white, then that would be a problem with our discrimination policies.
Thank you. I just wanted to read that from what the legislation said.
But I'm sure somebody will, like Harry said, somebody will be tested on it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Any questions about the legislative session and any bills that that would affect us that were... moving on to the federal, just to give you a brief update, maybe premature in this, as the federal budget proposal was just issued a few days ago, but in whatever homework I've been able to do since then, the administration of Washington made it clear that they intend to follow through on plans to increase defense spending by 10% or $4 billion and offset those increases by cutting discretionary spending by similar amounts. Discretionary areas of the federal budget include a lot of agencies and programs important to higher education, including spending on student aid programs and scientific research. Key elements that will affect education would include a reduction of $9.2 billion for the Department of Education compared to current funding levels, cutting its budget by 13.5%, eliminating funding for the Supplemental Education Opportunity Grant, the SEOG grant. The budget proposal states that SEOG is less targeted, is a less targeted way to deliver need-based aid than the Pell Grant. Fortunately, the Pell Grant was left untouched, maintaining the maximum Pell Grant award while reducing the program's current $10.6 billion surplus by $3.9 billion, but not reducing the actual awards. However, reducing the surplus could jeopardize the long-term sustainability of the Pell Grant program to provide grants on a year-round basis. Reduced funding for federal work-study, as well as making cuts to funding in the GEAR Up, down 10%, and the TRIO program, down 30%. The TRIO program is particularly important to us. It supports a lot of our students, particularly students, at-risk students, low-income students, so we're most concerned about that. It does maintain funding at a flat level for historically black colleges and universities. The budget calls for reduction of $5.8 billion for the National Institutes for Health, including calling for a major organization of NIH institutes and centers, reduced funding for National Endowment for the Humanities, National Endowment for the Arts, National Sea Grant College Program, and the Cooperation of National and Community Service, which runs AmeriCorps. We're particularly concerned with the funding for public broadcasting, which is why I asked David to remain with us. I do want to point out that this is President Trump's initial budget proposal. And as our local delegation in Kentucky has made it clear, this is only the first step in a long process. And I might also remind everyone that I believe, I may be wrong on this, but for the last 8 years, our federal government has not passed a budget. And so, you know, there's a lot of hand-wringing about, as well there should be, but there's a long way to go before these things could be enacted. And but it is ominous that these programs are getting a lot of scrutiny. Our public broadcasting is at the core of our in my opinion, at the core of our DNA as an institution. It's the federal funding that's at risk for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And David, you might share with the group about what percent of our public broadcasting budget comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, please.
Sure. We have a rough annual appropriation, the federal appropriation, of about $1.04 million. 39.7% of the television direct funded budget is federal. 16.2% of the radio budget direct funding is federal. Now, rural areas, and this is one of the things that is really critical that we have been communicating, and we've been working with Shea Hopkins from KET, Becky McGura from WCTE, which is the Cookeville PBS affiliate, Monica Reese from WLJT in Martin, Tennessee, Greg Petrowich from Southern Illinois University, Brad Kimmel from NIN. So when we talk about this region of the country, those are the main players in terms of PBS and NPR. We are all in a unified message that rural areas are affected in a much more negative fashion. And when we're still counting Bowling Green as a developing area, in how that federal appropriation is both used and what percentage of the budget that it accounts for. KET's perspective, their budget is 15.2% federal on the television side. Of course, they only have television. We're the only joint licensee in Kentucky, and that is another distinction that this university holds, is that because of the radio elements and television elements, as a university licensee, we are the only one that exists. And we see this as a critical part of our mission, our work with students, and that's the other benefit ratio that is we are now highlighting more than ever. 20% of the federal money we receive is allocated towards student salaries and their career development. And that's one out of every $5 goes and is appropriated that way. We do that for a particular reason. We believe that it's part of our mission as well. So when we talk about community outreach and engagement, we feel that we have, and I say this every year, but I think we can justify the allocation, we can justify the federal appropriation, we can justify the efforts to maintain that funding. I don't see any reason that this budget should be any different in the coming year. We know from our indications that the current fiscal year budget will not be affected. And I should also point out to this board, the CPB is forward funded by 2 years. Which is one of, there's only two government agencies that are funded that way, so we're really talking about 19 and 20 in terms of the federal funding model. But, as you have pointed out, there has not been a budget. So, as Senator Paul pointed out to me, he has yet to vote on CPB funding. He's only voted on a CR or an omnibus or any of those packages. So there really hasn't been a budget in his entire term in office, at least. So we have been, Dr. Ransdell has graciously spent, and I know he walked personally over 5 miles that day, because I tracked it on my phone. And I was like, my goodness, we're walking an awful lot. But we spent an entire day having direct meetings with the full endorsement of the Kentucky Broadcasters Association, which is the first time that they've done that on behalf of public broadcasting. Is Steve Newberry on our behalf worked? And we had a voted resolution to endorse public broadcasting as part of the lobbying effort of the KBA. And that was a big deal because they were doing that in front of Leader McConnell, a delegation breakfast with Hal Rogers. We met specifically with Congressman Guthrie and James Comer, and Congressman Comer, in a rare move, met with us without a staff member in the office. So that's the kind of good communication that we had. So I think that we're in the best position possible to correct this apparent oversight by our current president, and we'll make the best case and continue in this effort moving forward. And we are encouraging direct contact with representatives and senators to resolve this issue, not necessarily an email campaign, but we are going to be encouraging over this marathon, not this sprint, but this marathon process, direct contact to resolve this issue. We believe that it will be.
And if you need information, you have the annual report from WKU Public Broadcasting, PBS, and our NPR operations in front of you right here. So well done.
Well, that represents 1 year of activity only. That's another thing. That's just 1 year. So you've got a lot. Thank you.
Gary, could you enlighten the board on, but this is a national issue, and if it's a national budget, cuts wouldn't specifically, our contingency being for it, doesn't necessarily mean that we would receive a proportional share.
Not at all, but, you know, they're our go-to people. I mean, it's not going to do us any good to try to meet senators and representatives from other states.
No, just a clarification.
Yeah, but what we wanted to make sure was that our delegation would help. Hal Rogers has just completed a term as chair of the House A&R Committee, Appropriations and Revenue Committee. He's in an awfully strong position, and he could not have been more emphatic in terms of his support for broadcasting in general and public broadcasting specifically. Senator McConnell did as well. Guthrie and Comer did. Senator Paul was a little less committal, but he was pretty straightforward. He's one of those, I don't know that I'll fight for you, but I won't fight against you. Kind of a conversation. Fair assessment, David?
I think that's an outstanding assessment. And Andy Barr, Congressman Barr, has publicly been recognized last Saturday at a forum on Eastern Kentucky University's campus as coming out in favor as well. And that was one that was kind of on the fence.
Thank you.
Any other questions on the federal budget proposal overview? Yes, I do need that, please. Before we leave the federal and turn attention to the Kentucky Higher Education Performance Funding Model, let me circulate an article there's been a lot of discussion. You all read the paper, you see things and hear things, and the matter of the recent executive orders and impact on students. I thought this was a pretty good piece, which describes what higher education, tensions within higher education as regards to the recent executive orders as it relates to international populations. I thought it was pretty good. It gives you a pretty good summary of the kinds of dynamics that we're addressing with regard to the executive orders. I thought it was a fairly balanced commentary. So, higher ed performance funding model, I've sent you all a lot of information on this over the recent months, but let me go through this quickly, and I won't spend a lot of time on it, but I do want to answer any questions and give you a sense of where this stands. First of all, this was sent into law on Wednesday, and it is now the method through which the higher education appropriation will be distributed in the future. So a lot of money at stake and a lot of work went into this by the work group that met for the last year. And I was, I started to say enjoyed the opportunity to chair that group, but that probably would be generous. It was a good exercise, but getting the consensus agreement signed by December was a challenge, but we did. The goals are quickly increase bachelor's degrees, increase retention, progression towards timely graduation, grow the number of bachelor's degrees in STEM fields, and close the achievement gaps for underrepresented minorities and low-income students. It is an outcomes-based model. 70% is distributed on performance, 30% on vital campus operations. I'll address those a bit more in a moment. Includes all public four-year universities in the performance pool, but does have safeguards. And I'll address that a bit more in a moment. There is a small school adjustment, which is probably the biggest compromise to us in this model, and it does hold harmless and stop loss provisions for smaller institutions. The student success formula measures bachelor's degrees, degrees per 100 undergraduate full-time students, STEM plus health, underrepresented minority and low-income degrees, and student progression at 30, 60, 90-hour measures, and then course completion. Of number of courses completed by students on our respective campuses. The other variable that is not performance related is the share of your budget spent on maintenance and operations, institutional support, and academic support. And we have a calculation by which a portion of your current budget can be protected based on what you're currently investing in these three areas. If you want to look at how the money will be divided, Course completion, student success, academic support, institutional support, maintenance and operations is how the performance-related variables are calculated. Recommended phase-in. I will speak to the 5%. Remember, last spring, 5% of our budgets were withdrawn and held in Frankfort. 5% of the higher ed appropriation. And that was the leverage, that was the pressure point that prevailed upon this work group to get it done and get a model in place to which we could all agree, get it to the General Assembly, get a bill written, get the bill through the Senate and then through the House and then signed into law, was the fact that if we had not done that, we stood to lose that 5% funding, which is $42 million. So that was the leverage point. So I will show you approximately how that 5% will be now distributed before June 30. And then fiscal 18-19, now what the legislation calls for is 100% of the appropriation to be run through the model. There will be a hold harmless provision in the first year. The second year, a stop loss of 1% of an institution's budget. Year two, a stop loss of 2%. And from that point forward, no stop loss, no hold harmless. But the reason for the hold harmless is Kentucky State. And the reason for the stop loss, primarily the smaller institutions were concerned that the model primarily measures outcomes, which measure volume, which favors larger institutions. There were some provisions put in that measured rates that favors smaller institutions. But by and large, it is an outcomes-based model. So there are some provisions put in there to limit the competitive stress on some of the campuses in the first 3 years. And then after 3 years, the working group will reconvene and there will be a look back to determine what tweaks might need to be made in the model at that point in time. If you want some comparison, here's how we might compare to some other states in terms of course completion and progression and degree completion as a driver of funding. So that just gives you some sense about how we might compare to some other states as they put performance funding models in place. Kentucky's probably been among the more aggressive outside of Tennessee perhaps, in progression and degree completion.
Is that, I'm just sure, the stop loss provision means that you cannot lose more than that?
Yeah, that's correct. Which dilutes what the other campuses might gain with their performance in the early years. But again, that was important to get that done as
so
a compromise.
So if a campus did lose some, that is redistributable.
Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely.
It's not necessarily recurring, since you have to get it again every year.
The models are plugged in every year with the previous year's data. I won't go through this, but you have in front of you a one-page summary that describes the model quite clearly. I hope this is helpful to you. Again, I won't go through it. But what I do want to walk you through quickly is the spreadsheet that you have in front of you. This spreadsheet right here, if you can get that in front of you, because this is December 2006 information. Before it's finally completed, it'll be mid to late April when current year's data will be plugged into this. So this is data from last year, but it gives you a good sense of how the model affects the institution. So I'm going to walk you through this for as quickly as I can. Column A is the adjusted net general fund budget, meaning that the current higher ed budget is about $950 million. Take KCTCS out. They've got their own model, same model, but it's applied to the 16 KCTCS institutions. So the number you see here is for the state appropriation for the four-year campuses listed here. The small school adjustment, column B, this was painful for us because what that does is that protects that amount of money, and because UK and UOL have medical schools and larger budgets, that's why their protected amount is larger, but the same dollar amount for all the comprehensive universities. The reason that hurts us is protecting 4.7 million of Morehead and Murray's budget is protecting a much greater portion of their budget than protecting $4.7 million of our budget. And so that was a compromise in difference to the smaller institutions. That's why it's called a small school adjustment. Therefore, you subtract B from A to get C. The two outcomes-based components are comprising 70% of the model. I'm going to go through the student success variables in just a minute. 35%, 35%, just based on pure course completion, making the other category, and then going to the 10, 10, 10% of the operation components, maintenance operation, institutional support, academic support. Formula totals, dollar difference, base change. So if this model would be put into place right now, this year, based on last year's data, you can see who goes up and who goes down in the model. You can also see why Kentucky State has a hold harmless clause in it, because if you take $6.5 million out of Kentucky State's budget, they'd have to close. So what that does is it dilutes the amount to be gained by the other campuses.
Is that likely to be a continuing?
No, I don't think so. That was quite a compromise to do that. So I got a three-year notice to get ready. But if this were plugged in as we see it, our budget would go up $2.9 million or 4.2%. Now, the key variable to remember here is we're currently getting about 9.5% of the higher ed appropriation. You look at all of these measures, and you look at student success share, 12.5%, credit hour production, 12.8%, square footage, 8.8%. That primarily, we're hurt a little bit by that one because of the Student Life Foundation, because the square footage of all of our residence halls is not included in our calculation because we don't own those properties. Okay, the benefits we get from the Student Life Foundation offsets that. Direct cost share, FTE, student share for academic support. All of these measures were above 12% of the metric, and we're currently getting 9.5% of the higher ed budget. So you can see how, based on our current performance, a performance funding model is good for us. And you see how we go up. To get into just briefly the outcomes-based components, turn over to the next page. You see 35% of the allocable resources, contribution totals, and then bachelor's degrees, STEM plus H, underrepresented minorities, low income. You turn the page over, 30, 60, 90 credit hours. And you see at the bottom of each column, percent of total, under bachelor's degrees, 9%, STEM plus H, 5%. That's how much of the funding is tied to that metric to make up that 35% of the total. And so these are the real performance measures right here on these two pages. And again, just based on these measures, 35% of the funding model, the dollar difference is, you can see in column E on the second page there, $1.3 million net gain to us, 6% difference, percent share, 12.5%. So you can see who goes up and who goes down based on this 35% variable for these metrics of bachelor's degrees, STEM plus H, underrepresented, low income, and then 30, 60, 90 progression. So that gives you a pretty good sense of how. Now, these will change slightly when current year's data is plugged in and it goes into effect for next year, but not dramatically. My point in all of this is this has to be front and center in the university's next strategic plan. Actions on our part that affect these metrics have to be at the core of our strategic planning process going forward. Everything else pales in comparison because it will drive funding. So all the things we talked about earlier with retention and Peggy's thoughts and all that goes into what can we do to drive up these numbers, including the STEM variable that we talked about. So that's the performance funding model. Now turn to the last page. This page, as of December, as of last year's data, shows how the 5% that was withdrawn from our budget last year will be distributed. It's this last page, the 8.5 by 11 page. Yeah. That's at the back of your spreadsheets here. It's at table 3. Distribution of post-secondary education performance fund. So, again, looking at the $42 million was withdrawn, $33 million related to the four-year campuses. The balance was in KCTCS, so we're only looking at the four-year campus You take away mandated program adjustments. In your case, it's their medical school. I have no idea why there's a zero by U of L on that. That might be their extension service. That might not be the medical school. That's part of their extension service as a mandated program. Our mandated program is the Gatton Academy, for example. And so then you get your formula share. So our share of what was contributed to that 5% pool was 12.2%. Performance distribution, you can see that we get $139,500 more than we contributed to that 5% pool. You follow me?
Mm-hmm.
If you run the spreadsheet, we go up slightly, some institutions go down, and that's approximately how that 5% will be redistributed to the campuses based on plugging this formula into it. These numbers will shift a little bit when they come out in April with existing current year data, but this is, as the data we now know it, how it would shake out. So, man, that is a quick summary of a long, complex process and funding dynamic. But I think you get a pretty good sense of it and the importance of it.
As you have digested this and analyzed it, there's some of these areas that are going to be stronger than others, but is there any one of these components that we're particularly needing to give attention to be sure we hit target?
We have to drive up graduates. And you reminded me, Barbara, but to answer your question, you have to drive up degree completion, particularly in the STEM, underrepresented minority, low-income degree categories, and one of the values of students completing dual credit courses and coming to WKU, while we need to enroll those 2,300 students that are taking dual credit with us, because they come in, and they may be only one or two courses shy of that 30-hour progression measure, and they're going to be pretty quick to that 60-hour because of the dual credit they're bringing in. So, all of the above, we have to drive performance in these metrics, and that's going to be our single most important challenge going forward. I will say, a lot of compromises in this process. We compromised significantly on the small school adjustment. UK and U of L compromised significantly because it only counts bachelor's degrees. However, those degrees were weighted, and UK and U of L had a higher rating for most of these degree categories. If the comprehensive universities had a 1.0 value placed on a degree, a STEM plus H degrees for UK and U of L were 1.56, underrepresented minority 1.23, progression 1.56, so on. Because of the investments they have to make in their graduate schools, particularly their medical school and their professional degrees. If we're only going to measure bachelor's degrees, then the compromise and the negotiation was, we'll weight our bachelor's degrees a little bit more. And, you know, my goal was to get all eight presidents to sign a consensus document at the end of the day that says we support the model, which we were able to achieve. So a lot of compromise, a lot of give and take. There are some things in here that, why in the world did we do that, or did you do that? We had to get it done. We had to get a model done, or we stood to lose $42 million. And this is a better model. The other thing this does, and this is a really important factor. For 20 years, Jennifer, they've been dragging me to Frankfurt to fight for this and fight for that come every budget session. This takes politics out of the appropriation of higher education funding. Mm-hmm. I don't need to go. No president needs to go and fight for funding within the higher ed budget, because this will determine how the higher ed money is distributed, both current and new money. For example, if through tax reform, higher education somehow ends up with more money, it will be distributed through this formula. So all the presidents aren't up there bumping into each other, coming in and out of legislators' office saying, do this for me. That dynamic still exists on capital projects, but not for base funding.
So the CPE, that big block of money that was $900 million or whatever, $950 million, that was divided by a formula, is gone.
Well, it wasn't a formula. It was just at some point in time, every institution had a share of it, 20 or 30 or 40 or 50 years ago.
Yes.
And as more money came available, you got the same share. As budget cuts were made, you were cut by the same share. There was no rhyme or reason, which is why we watched our funding per student drop from $7,200 per student to $4,500 per student as we grew by six and a half thousand students from 1998 to 2008.
Well, they spent almost 3 years studying the $50 million extra and never did address that. So now this will address, it levels the playing field at least by rules.
And there is a variable in here called equilibrium that will help institutions that are underfunded proportionately, that will come to us at the first pass of new money.
If we get new money.
If we get new money.
Wow.
But and so that was also a highly negotiated variable in the mix.
Do you see at any point graduate students becoming a factor in this model?
You know, I don't for a while. Now, you know, who knows what will happen 3 years when the work group is reconvened to look back. And
what was the question?
Do I see graduate degrees being included? And from our standpoint, it's better that it only measures bachelor's degrees.
Mm. That makes sense.
Okay. But we'll see what happens over the course of time. But that was a big compromise for UK and U of L to concede to only major.
Well, it's also a difficult institution. If you're looking at where program development and enrollment growth can come, you're making a conscious decision to move resources to something that doesn't count at the state level. Now, I guess you weigh that with what it will bring otherwise.
Of course. Of course.
Right.
We're not going to de-emphasize graduate programs because of this model. We're just
good.
Not. Because it's pretty fortuitous. There's an economic development strategy behind every graduate program. There's revenue. There's responsibility. It's part of our mission. We're going to grow our graduate programs every way we possibly can. So I wouldn't want one to assume that because this model only measures bachelor's degrees that we're going to de-emphasize graduate programs. That would not be accurate. And I don't think the president of any other institution would say that same thing.
Gary, could you just expand a little bit on that equilibrium? Because I feel like that's something that we need to have just enough information that we can be sure that everybody's conscious of it, and it not, because that could be a big factor. So when you say equilibrium, if new money comes, can you give us any kind of measurement of what that might mean?
Well, I'm going to be hesitant about throwing a number out there.
I can appreciate
but
that.
It would be a few million dollars that would allow equitable appropriations per student as an initial step in the implementation of the model. But, again, a compromise was that will likely be done with new money rather than existing money. In other words, the intent is not to take money from other campuses to make NKU and WKU whole. The intent would be to first make us whole with new money and then distribute the rest based on the formula.
So there's still this kind of, like, this 30-year kind of attitude about how the money will be distributed if it's not a true equilibrium then?
Well, it will be, and CPE has a formula for doing that. But, again, I don't want to throw a number out there because all
that's
of a sudden that's what people gravitate to.
Sure.
You know, that's,
and budget for.
And that's a delicate matter, and I get that.
I'm such a good
Yeah.
I don't know how this might look different.
Well, frankly, I tried not for that to be a factor in the process. And I think the fact that I'm retiring and the fact that WK was going to fare well in most any model that was conceived were the two primary reasons why Governor Bevin asked me to chair the work group, and the president's concurred and appointed me to do that was because I was in a position to perhaps be a bit more objective than others maybe might be. And I believe I was objective throughout this process. So this is important. I know these are a lot of numbers and so on, but it's significant for us going forward. Anything else I can answer on this model? Jennifer, leave anything out?
Good practice for being seasick, if you ask me. That's
a good
one. I think it concludes executive, and that will conclude our scheduled agenda items. You will note under other business our calendar of events coming up. Put that on your radar. Any other comments or questions? I know it's been a long day.
Good day.
Remember that short day you had not too long ago. Told you payback would be coming. So it's been a great meeting, and we got a lot of background, fundamental foundation information.
Yeah, I think that's one.
I'll be a short meeting next time.
Yeah.